Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. Today, our guest is Andrew Erickson, who for the last 2 years was the Columbus Crew beat reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. He moved on to other things professionally since the season ended, but he very kindly agreed to talk about Greg Berhalter, the next U.S. men's national team coach, to give us some perspective on who he is, what it's like to cover him as a head coach and sporting director, and hopefully give us a few anecdotes about life with 3G. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, you bet.
So you were a pretty young reporter when you started covering the Crew in 2016, if I'm not mistaken, and Berhalter had already been in Columbus for 3 years. What was your initial impression of him, and how did you meet him the first time?
The first time I met him was as an intern with the Columbus Dispatch in late 2015 when I was helping out in our playoff coverage. Getting started, it was 2017 preseason, kind of learning – what made him tick, how he was as a coach, how he dealt with the media. So all that kind of stuff takes time. I think for me coming in, I came in not knowing a ton about soccer, not knowing a ton about the intricacies of the game, and, came in wanting to learn more about it. And I think that was good in that sense. He's able to break things down and explain them. Even if it's not on the record, he can pull out a whiteboard and kind of explain why certain things work or why certain guys work in certain lineups or formations. So as someone who came in trying to learn more about the game, I thought he did a good job and receptive to wanting to explain it to someone who was curious about it.
That's cool. So what was he had you like in front of a whiteboard talking about tactics with you?
I mean, occasionally, if you ask about something specific, he'll pull out a whiteboard and kind of show you, why certain things happen. But I wasn't like a daily thing or anything like
sure.
that. Just, whenever I was curious about what made something work, especially kind of further on down the road as we got to know each other better, I think that was, that was a nice part of the, the day-to-day interactions.
That's cool. So what... Do you remember anything specific that he explained to you in that way?
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah.
A couple times against the Red Bull, they played like long balls instead of playing short. Like they, they're always known for their playing out of the back style and kind of not playing direct and playing out of the back, that pretty style of soccer. And then a couple times against the Red Bulls, they've played more direct and. Kind of went through the tactics of why that works. And this is nothing he would reveal, obviously, before a game, but kind of after of, hey, how did you come to this decision? How was this, how was this the decision you came to when you were compiling your lineup? And so I think that was one that kind of stuck out for me.
Yeah, that's interesting because I was going to ask later, and I'll just ask it right now. I was at a press conference with Dave Sarokin a few months ago, and he used the phrase, I don't want to get too technical, before not getting very technical at all. This was after the Brazil loss. And I wonder, I was going to ask, do you think Berhalter will be more anxious or more willing to break down the technical parts of soccer, assuming he is named as the men's national team coach, than maybe a Sarokin has been?
Well, I think it's just apples to oranges because the stage is so much bigger. Mm-hmm. You have way more reporters in there for a national team camp. You're going to have, 15, 20 reporters, whereas in Columbus, typically the maximum number of people that would be at practice would be two. So you have a lot more face-to-face interaction, and, the stakes of it in a day-to-day kind of sense are just not as large. So I think it is a bit apples to oranges. I think his true colors in the sense that he embraces tactics and, analytical soccer, I think will come through, but I just think the stage is so different that, that might adjust that in a way.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
For those of us on the outside looking in, Berhalter's persona is just cool, calm, and kind of quiet. Is that what he's like up close?
I think it depends. I don't think he gets particularly like angry or upset or anything about what people write, or, you know, I think that is actually a good description of it, in the sense that, you know, even when they'd have like a 3-game win streak, he would just say, you know how quickly it can turn. They would lose 3 games. That happened, you know, I think maybe 2 times when I was on the beat. It was, you know, I think we played well in these games, so we're not going to overreact about it. So I think there was never, like, panic, and he would never get too, I don't know, his teams never really felt themselves in that way. Like, I think they could always kind of check themselves, to avoid a letdown. I think maybe there was some of that later in the year when it was, like, looking very likely that they were going to make the playoffs, and then the team kind of faded down the stretch. Mm-hmm. So maybe there was some of that. But I never got from him specifically that, they were struggling with anything like that, you know, that or that they would ever get too high or too low.
Yeah, okay. Have you ever seen Berhalter angry?
Only in rare instances. One of them was July 2017, I want to say, after a 3-0 loss to the Philadelphia Union at Talon Energy Stadium. He was particularly upset about the officiating and brought something up about referees working, you know, international games in addition to MLS games. I think was forced, you know, part of it, I think, was to distract from the fact that his team did not play a good game, and I think was kind of sticking up for his players. And, he went into the press conference room knowing that he was going to be fined, and sure enough, he was fined. And it was the same week that Mike Pecky had his famous rant, the Pass About Trey rant, and then I think somebody else had one that same week. But, I would say that, you know, they're few and far between when it happens. Typically, you know, it's trying to make a point, but it's not like he ever made a habit out of that. We would occasionally talk about things I'd written, but for the most part, I didn't hear anything. I think, as we talked about before, he did a pretty good job of staying even keel, and that was for the most part, you know, how we interacted during my time on the beat, just, you know, kind of even keel, never too high, never too low kind of attitude.
Okay. What was your sense of how the players responded to him and his rapport with the team?
I think when you would ask guys about teams they had played on before the crew, or, you know, stops they had made prior to coming to Columbus, it was just the level of preparation, the level of detail was just higher than it was in those other places. And, you know, when you talk to like a Josh Williams, when he was in NYC and when he was in Toronto, and obviously had a lot of respect for Greg Manny, but just he just mentioned that, you know, the preparation level for Greg, I think, was just, it's just unrivaled. And, you know, you talk to certain guys like Josh Zardes about, the level of instruction that he was given from Josh Wolf and Greg Berhalter, it was just very high, and allowed him to not have to think as much and allowed him to be more successful as a forward. So you hear certain anecdotes, and obviously, you know, guys that feel like they should be playing on a roster and aren't playing, you know, won't always love a coach when,
sure.
But I would say that's true of any team, not just the crew. I would say, generally speaking, he had a good rapport with the players. And I think, you know, he's not the biggest rah-rah guy in the world, but I would say that, there was a level of respect there, just his level of preparation and his knowledge of the game.
Who was that player? You cut out a little bit, but who was that player that you mentioned who came from NYCFC and Toronto?
Josh Williams, the center back, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it sounds like he was very approachable to reporters. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but how much did he talk about the...
No, definitely.
He was? Okay. Well, how much did he talk about the 4-2-3-1 and the system? And I guess I know you sort of already talked about that, but my follow-up on that is, did you get bored with that kind of stuff? And did your editors get bored with that sort of stuff? And was there a gap between sort of what he was interested in talking about and what the paper was interested in publishing?
think there was ever like a disconnect there, gap there. I mean, obviously there are going to be weeks where, you know, it's more, the well's more dry than it would be in another week, or, you know, there are other weeks where there's a lot going on, or there are multiple transactions, or the game is particularly compelling and allowed for a greater. But I would say, you know, you mentioned the system, like the 4-2-3-1. I think that came up when it was talking about, like, other formations. Like, say they would play a 4-4-2 late in the game with bringing Patrick Mullins on, or, you know, they played three in the back a handful of times. I think a lot of it was, okay, while the formation is different, the philosophy of the team remains the same, in the sense that, you know, they want to disrupt opponents through through possession and through organizing their attack and building out of the back, and how, you know, they tried to keep that same philosophy even when they had stretches, you know, particularly last season in 2017, when, you know, they were playing three in the back and playing with three center backs. So, you know, I think that was more kind of explaining just how the philosophy stays constant, you know, and in certain cases why you would stick with that, you know, the certain parameters of that, or positioning, or, you know, tweaks that can be made over time. So I think that was always a discussion. Obviously, with any coach and the media, there's certain things you're willing to reveal and certain things you're not. But, no, I definitely thought he was approachable during the 2 years I covered the team.
Did he ever talk about his time in Sweden and what he learned there?
I would say maybe not as much on the record about that, just in the sense that I think, well, I would say on the record primarily it was, you know, that he developed as a coach. And I think he would even say that was true from later in his tenure in Columbus to looking back on earlier in his tenure. He was able to be more flexible with his system, able to implement players in different ways that maybe as a younger coach he was a little bit more rigid, or maybe a little bit less certain in the way he made those changes. So I think it was just, he maybe talked about his evolution of confidence, you know, and how he learned how to be more flexible with the lineups he employed and the way he used players. I think that kind of fed into Sweden maybe a little bit. There'd be anecdotes obviously here and there, but just about his maybe evolution as a coach, that was discussed over time.
Okay. Interesting. Did he, I'm assuming the answer is probably not much, but I wonder if he ever talked about what he learned under Bruce Arena at the Galaxy, because you played for the Galaxy for a year or two and then was an assistant before he went to Sweden. Did that ever come up?
I think, you know, occasionally, and he always talked about Bruce Arena as his mentor, and, you know, certain little nuggets he learned from him. You know, talking to Hector Jimenez, one of the fullbacks on the team that actually the crew traded for, almost immediately after Greg became the head coach. He was, you know, a reserve player when Greg ran the reserve team for the Galaxy. And he just talked about, you know, he saw me as a right back. I'd never played right back in my life. And, you know, kind of saw certain attributes in guys that, you know, he thought, okay, that was an early instance of, you know, witnessing this guy being pretty able to identify talent and identify certain attributes. You know, I think the one anecdote recently was he always saw Jossie Zardes as a forward, and I wouldn't say I was taken aback by it when they first acquired him, but it was very clear early on that he was going to be afforded that opportunity to win the starting striker job, and, you know, they thought that he was, you know, a pretty good hold-up player. That he was pretty good, you know, receiving crosses, that his work rate was really high. And it was just identifying those attributes where, you know, toward the end of Jossie Zardes' tenure with the Galaxy, he was playing fullback. And I believe he played on the wing some, but, you know, the crew kind of always saw him as a forward. And, you know, I think that fit worked out well just in the team system. But, you know, I think a lot of that depends on what type of system he wants to play with the national team. And, like I said, you know, how big or how diverse his player pool is.
Okay. Okay. Do you know if he speaks any languages besides English?
Yes. He speaks fluent Spanish, German, and I believe some Dutch, just from his playing days.
All right. Well, that's good. That's probably out there on the internet somewhere, but I'm glad to hear it. So the Kai Kamara trade is widely interpreted as a good example of how Berhalter does not tolerate a player putting himself above the team. Is that a fair way to look at it? And are there other examples of Berhalter emphasizing, the sort of the team and the system over an individual?
I don't know. And, to be honest with you, I wasn't on the beat when that Kai Kamara, Federico Higuain thing went down. So that's kind of hard for me to speculate. Obviously it wasn't a good situation. And those guys, it was clear based on that that there it was a huge blow up. But I think it's hard to say on that. Last summer, Federico Higuain said that, he was thinking about, retiring from soccer, or that 2017 season being his last with the Crew, and it was over the fact that he wasn't under contract the following season, and the club hadn't yet completed its negotiations with him, and so he was frustrated. I think Greg was pretty calm, even keel about that. I think there was some uncertainty for a while as to whether Federico Higuain was going to be back, but they ultimately worked out an extension, and he had a strong finish of the 2017 season, had a pretty good 2018, and is obviously under contract for 2019. So there are certain cases where that does work out, even if a guy expresses his, discontent. There are other cases where I think the, Billy Duco was upset about, I think he tweeted something out one time, and they kind of came to the decision that, mutually agreed that the team would release him and allow him to explore other opportunities. Kai Kamara and Justin Merrim, I'm sorry, Ola Kamara and Justin Merrim both requested trades last year. It wasn't ever a vicious or an angry discussion there, but, he made it clear that, if you're a player who asks for a trade, that, the team can't guarantee where you'll go, and they'll do what's best for the team. So, I think with any team, there are always those circumstances of either a player doesn't want to be there, or it doesn't work out, or something goes wrong in discussions, or the team doesn't want to pay a player maybe as much as he thinks he's worth. But I think it never got super vicious or ugly in that sense. It was just hey, here's what we maybe need to do based on a guy asking for a trade, and you move on and work out with the pieces you try to. Have on your roster, and that's essentially how they approached it.
Okay. Well, everyone in Columbus and Berhalter in particular had a lot of off-field drama to navigate during your time covering the team. That's all very well documented. But how would you say he handled all that? I mean the potential move to Austin and mostly that.
Yeah, I remember in February of this season, I think it was just easier with the playoffs just because naturally a team insulates itself to outside noise during that time. You kind of huddle together a little bit more than you would during the regular season. So I think 2018, that regular season, was always going to be a test. And I remember sitting down with him in Charleston, South Carolina, for the preseason. We did some sit-down interviews somewhere in the city, and I remember saying to him, I think a lot of people would say if this team does not perform well or the team falls flat this season, no one's going to blame you. Has that thought ever crossed your mind, or did it cross your mind? And I remember I followed up on that same question probably September or October. And I think he's not one to make excuses. I think they recognize that it was a difficult season. But I think he and the player, and I give a lot of credit to the players too, did a pretty good job of insulating things, deflecting questions. And, I think there's a part of me that wished they maybe would have been more open about it or talked about it. But at the same time, they're employees of the team. And so, there's always going to be a limit to what they can say. But I think they did a pretty good job of insulating things because the season very easily, based on that, could have spiraled out of control. And I don't think they were going to let that happen. I think it was just, again, just kind of staying calm, and I never think they let panic set in, and I think that's what allowed them, even though they struggled toward the end of the season, kind of allowed them
What's your guess? Is Will Trapp going to be the starting central defensive midfielder for the national team on day one of the Berhalter era?
I don't know about that. I think if you have both Weston McKennie and Tyler Adams in the mix, I think that's going to be, I think it's going to be, I think there, it could be tough to have him in the lineup on a regular basis. That being said, I think he knows how Greg operates. And he, Greg knows too that Will works hard and, can be a leader and can kind of help communicate, certain parts of the system, if that is indeed what, he continues to do with the national team. But no, I think Will just be a good guy to have around, whether he's the starter or not, or whether he's playing consistently or not. I think it's a guy who's, for the most part played well on the international stage, has definitely taken a step up, this year. But whether he's the starter, I think that's hard to say.
Yeah. Okay. You've been to, I just got a couple more questions. You've been to some crew practices, I assume. What is he like there? Is he like Nick Saban, bouncing around, instructing everyone, or more hands-off with a clipboard on the sideline?
No, I typically would see the tail end of practices. I've seen longer stretches occasionally. I think it's just very detail-oriented. Like, he'll pull guys aside occasionally and kind of discuss certain topics or certain movements or certain cues that they might see on the field with them. Obviously he has guys like Josh Wolf and Nico Estevez and Pat Onstad that help, with the day-to-day management of practice. But, he's definitely out and about kind of talking to players and, explaining a concept. He'll have his whiteboard out. But, I'd say pretty typical for any coach, kind of pulling guys aside when you need to, or, in other cases, just, addressing the group as a whole.
Okay. Well, you're, as the listeners can probably notice, you're on the road, and you're leaving your job as the crew beat reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, heading for new opportunities. I guess I'd ask you to sort of reflect back on the last two years. What are some of the most memorable anecdotes you have about Berhalter? Like, what are you going to remember about him?
That's a difficult question. I would say I respected the fact that he was willing to teach certain parts of the game, willing to explain the game a little bit more. Obviously, like any other coach, there were times when he was guarded, but I think it was a positive relationship over 2 years, and obviously, like I said, there's just more eyeballs on the national team than there would be in a place like Columbus. But I'm curious to see just how that goes from a media standpoint, and how he continues to develop as a coach. There's certain stages that he's had in his career, whether we can talk about Hammerby or early Columbus crew, where it was a very rigid 4-2-3-1, and they really didn't deviate a whole lot. And then later on, kind of when they were willing to dabble with new formations and make certain lineup changes that they wouldn't have earlier in their tenure there. So, it's interesting to see that development. I definitely enjoyed learning more about the game for sure.
Okay, well, I'm not a sports reporter in my day job, but I am a reporter at a newspaper like you were, and I know that I form opinions about the people I cover. Some are, some people are more substantive than their public persona. Other people are less so. Some are nicer and funnier than a lot of people realize, and some are the other way around. What is Berhalter like? Very open-ended question, but take it however you want.
Yeah,
what's he like?
Maybe sometimes people see just like a super serious guy all the time. He does have a pretty dry sense of humor. I'm curious to see like to what level, how comfortable he'll have to be on a national team stage for that to kind of come out. But obviously very bright guy. He'll pick apart a bad question. I mean, I think he's a smart guy and he respects smart questions, but I think, if you don't bring it, It's not like he'll yell at you or anything like that, but it's like I think there's an appreciation for coming in prepared and doing things the right way. Yeah, I think I would also say he probably got more open with myself and Patrick Murphy, a massive reporter, who are the two primary reporters who cover the team just about every day. Just that became more open over time. So, to what extent that happens with the national team or how quickly that happens, I think would be speculative at this point. But, I'm interested to see, how that transformation takes place.
Okay. Well, is there anything else I should be asking about that I'm not?
I think that just about covers it, yeah.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much for doing this in a busy time for you, and all the best in your next endeavors, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you for putting up with the road noise. I appreciate it.
No, it's the audio's good. All right, thanks, man. U17s played 3 matches at the Nike friendlies in Florida over the past 6 days. It was a good chance to see the talent in this age group with World Cup qualification looming. Plenty of new information on players for whom we have not much information, or for whom the information is evolving. I've got Matt Hartman with me today. Greg is too cynical for U17s talk, and Joey Anthone is prioritizing real life this Monday night. So it's just us two. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing good, Adam. Thanks for having me on again. Not much of a life to prioritize here. So all yours for the next hour.
So. Awesome. Okay. So the U.S. drew Portugal 1-1 in the first game with a goal from Griffin Yao, beat Turkey 1-0 with a goal from Ricardo Pepi, and drew Brazil 1-1 with a goal from Gianluca Busio. 3 respectable results if viewed in a vacuum. Let's start off super binary. Were these friendlies a success or a failure?
I think it's hard to look at the results and call the tournament a failure. We did take 7 points off of Brazil, Portugal, and Turkey, which will never not be a decent return. For
5 points. Season. 5 points, right?
Right, you're right. 5 points. Right, well, that's maybe a little less impressive, but my complaints with our performance at the friendlies are centered around how we played, especially compared to how the last 2 cycles played against similar opposition. Mm-hmm. That's somewhat on the coaching staff and I think somewhat on the players. But I wouldn't call it a failure, just maybe not the success we were hoping for.
Yeah, it wasn't a smashing success, that's for sure. I think the games were not easy on the eyes. We rarely strung passes together. A lot of just like grinding soccer, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, I'd agree. And there's a lot of things that I think point towards that as to why that might have happened. For example, the closing of the residency, which we lauded as something that was good for U.S. soccer. But I think in these friendlies, we may have seen one of the downsides in the fact that the team looked like they lacked cohesion the whole tournament. And perhaps it's hard to and wrong to pinpoint the team's performance entirely on the closing of Bradenton. But I do think it does point to us losing an advantage in these youth tournaments, not only because our players aren't comfortable with each other's tendencies and movement, but perhaps even more so because the coaching staff isn't able to build, a system around the strengths of the player group.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to call it a success in the sense that I feel like we learned about a lot of players. We learned about a lot of players' limitations. At least I did. And, I think we saw some players sort of grow into the friendlies as they went along. Not too many, but a couple that are worth noting later on. Do you think, how much do you think the sort of not great soccer that they played in these games, the results could have easily been 3-1-1 draws. It could have easily been 3 wins, 3 narrow wins. And it, even more easily, I think, could have been worse than 3-1-1 draws. Like, we could have lost each of these games very easily, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if you're going to point to two things that two reasons why these friendlies were perhaps not as successfully as far as points go compared to the last two cycles, I think you're going to put that mostly on the lack of talent that's in this group, which is something that we touched on a little bit on our preview for the U17 cycle.
Yeah, a few weeks ago.
That the talent in this age group just isn't in the places that you'd want them to be, that you'd want it to be for the team to be very successful in tournaments like this, where you know, strikers and number 10s really rule, and number 8s really, you know, are super important to what teams are doing. I don't know that anybody but Scally, Lass, and Reyna would have started for our U17 team 2 years ago. And we did have arguably our best player missing, which isn't something that the previous cycles had to deal with.
Yeah. So the in other words, the premier talent on this team is at fullback, goalkeeper, and I mean, we don't know what Reyna's position really is.
Right, wherever you decide Reyna plays.
Yeah. Do you blame Sean Sakiris at all for the way they played, or are you basically just putting it on the where the talent is on the field and the sort of the non-residency lack of familiarity within the roster?
I have my issues with the coaching staff that I'll touch on when we get into the midfield, but I think it's mostly unfair to label Sakiris a bad coach due to these games. You know, from what I gather, he's well regarded in youth coaching circles and has had some pretty good results recently with this team. Mm-hmm. But I think I definitely would have gone into the Nike friendlies with a different mindset and perhaps a couple different players than he did. What did you think of Sakiris in this tournament?
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to evaluate tactics in a game like this given all these other factors. But I didn't like the fact that, I mean, it seemed as the tournament went on that we missed a player like Gilbert Fuentes or Josh Atencio for their sort of ability on the ball and intelligence. When I'm talking about intelligence, I'm thinking of Atencio more, and ability on the ball, I'm thinking of Fuentes. We just didn't have any way to seize control of the game in the middle of the pitch.
Right.
With the guys that we had. And that was a pretty big disappointment.
I understand Atencio being left off to a point just because we do have a number of players that were in this team that that play a similar position, if not similar to the exact style that he plays with. But man, right. Especially Monday morning quarterbacking after this is over, like the absence of Fuentes seems inexplicable, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'd go so far as inexplicable, but yeah, it's hard to understand for sure. Yeah, why don't we do just some quick recaps of the games, and then we'll get into some conclusions that we've drawn. Against Portugal, we scored on a mistake, a loose pass backward, and then a horrible first touch from Portuguese center back, and Griffin Yao pounced on it. I think he took one touch to take it off the guy's foot and then another to shoot at the near post. Not a very pretty goal, nothing that really speaks to the health of the squad in any way. But I do think we were maybe the better team for that first half, at least.
And yeah, I'd agree. We looked probably the best that we looked in the tournament against Portugal for a little while.
Yeah.
We had a couple of pretty good moments, and I think that the scoreline could have been in our favor, but you know, it's just how it works at these tournaments. Sometimes each team is going to get like, you know, four or five decent chances, and it seemed like especially being the game where Ocampo Chavez started, that we were kind of missing what Pepe brought later up front in this game, and maybe that would have made the difference on the score sheet. But I was pretty okay with the team performance against Portugal.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was our best performance, particularly in the first half of the friendlies. And I'll be honest, I don't really care about winning this friendly tournament. I mean, it doesn't matter to me at all. So, like, it's too bad we didn't win, but not really that big of a deal. The goal that Portugal scored was a long ball, a relatively innocuous long ball down the left wing, down our right flank. Scally was in pursuit, and he kind of over-pursued. I don't know if he got megged or just got the ball pushed past him, but he got beat. And then the Portuguese winger, whose name I don't know, played a ball across, and it was one-touched into the goal. Pretty much an unstoppable shot once that ball was played across.
Yeah, there was nothing Loss could do about it. I think that you'd expect a player of Scally's caliber to do a little better in that situation, but he a lot was asked of him in this game. You know, Portugal got the better of our center backs pretty early on, and Scally, a player that usually likes to be up and down the field, was, you know, had to stay a little further back than he normally would want to. And then, you know, for like the 20 or 25 minutes or so before the Portuguese goal, he was running up and down the sideline, you know, trying to get involved. And, you know, it looked like it took a little bit out of him. And I'm not willing to beat him up over getting beat on that ball. But, yeah, it's he should do a little better there.
Yeah, it was his mistake, no doubt about it. But he was still one of the best performers for the U.S. in this string of games. Against Turkey, so we won that one 1-0. That was on Friday night. Ricardo Pepi was the goal scorer, and I thought he had a really good game. Came in to replace Alfonso Ocampos Chavez, and for the goal, it was a kind of a galloping run from Gio Reyna, starting at midfield on the left side of the field, and sort of cutting towards the middle. He was doing a lot of dribbling past people in all three of these games, and this was an example where he beat a couple guys and then just kind of dumped it laterally to Pepi at the top of the box. Not an extremely dangerous situation for Turkey, but Pepi looked out wide like he was going to play a pass to the winger, or it might have been Scally overlapping, I don't remember, and then just decided to have a go, and he used the defender as a screen, took a low shot at the near post, and the goalkeeper couldn't get to it. Was not a golazo by any stretch, but it went in, and then we held on. I mean, Turkey did threaten a lot in the second half, particularly, I thought, and could have easily scored.
Yeah, this is the game where maybe, like, if you were to look at the expected goals, if such a thing existed for a U17 Nike Friendlies game.
It's a premium Opta product, probably, right?
Right. That we probably wouldn't be on the winning end of that duel, but, you know, great solo effort by Reyna to get the ball to the feet of Pepi, and then, you know, great understanding of Pepi to understand the situation that he was in, that he could sneak that ball into to the near post because the goalie was screened. You know, that really was the difference in the game where, like you said, Turkey maybe could have had two.
Yeah. It's hard to remember all the instances where they could have scored, but I feel like the Turkey game was one where Mason Judge was particularly culpable. There was one instance I'll bring up where he had a giveaway about at midfield, and then a ball kind of over the top where he just got bullied by a Turkish attacker who got inside him and then played it across the face of goal to another Turkish attacker standing right at the six. And meanwhile, the goalkeeper for this game, who was Odunze,
inexplicably charged out at the first, at the crosser, and left
the goal open.
Yeah, Hernandez in no man's land defending the goal by himself, which he did a really good job of disrupting the Turkish player to give Judge time to get back onto the line. But yeah, not Judge's brightest moment.
Yeah, and I thought that was maybe outside of Pepe's goal, maybe the play of the game from Hernandez there to just make it difficult for the attacker to turn and then difficult for him to get anything behind the shot. Finally, we played Brazil on Sunday night, and I think probably a lot of people were looking forward to that one. Gianluca Busio joined the squad, and he scored a goal on a cross from Gio Reyna. It was a great cross and a good finish from Busio. It was probably Busio's only good touch in the game.
Yeah, I'd agree.
the play started with some hard work from Pepe, Stroud, and Gray, who were kind of like the workhorses of this side throughout the friendlies, those three. And they've kind of forced a loose touch that was intercepted by Judge. Judge poked it to Busio. Busio turned and started running at the Brazilian defense. His pass forward to Reyna was a bit lucky to make it through. It was deflected to Reyna's feet. But then Reyna kind of just danced around down on the end line, which is, like I said, something he did a lot of, and then pulled it back from the end line very nicely, I thought, to a crashing Busio, who side foots it in with his left foot down and past the keeper.
Yeah, good goal. Great work by Reyna. I think you could ask some questions of the defense letting him get that ball in, because by the time he danced around for a while, like you said, and by the time he got the cross in, there were like three defenders defending him, and like everybody got sold on one, you know, fake pass that gave him the space to open up, you know, towards the sideline and get the ball into the middle. But yeah, great work to get it done. And then I think it was a pretty decent finish by Busio to get it past the keeper.
Yeah. And then Brazil scored on a free kick that was, you could argue Lass should have gotten to it. I'm not going to argue that. I'm not enough of a goalkeeping expert. It was a really nice free kick right over the wall. And Brazil could have had, you know, Brazil, had they been a little more toothful, could have scored more goals than that. It was a pretty hard game to watch, but I did it. I watched it all the way through.
Right. Yeah. Definitely the hardest game to watch of the bunch. Brazil was like weirdly physical for what you'd expect of a Brazilian youth national team. I'd say even that they were maybe more physical than they were technical. And if there was a different referee on the day, then maybe, you know, the cards would have started flying a little earlier. But it's not something that this team isn't going to have to deal with going forward, given that their next major tournament is in CONCACAF.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's good training for that, really. And, I mean, Gio Reyna drew a lot of fouls, which is kind of how he plays. And there were a few times where I thought, you know, just like, rather than try to draw the foul, why don't we like attack here? You know, he'll get on the other side of a guy. Maybe he was just getting hacked to death. He'll get on the other side of the guy. And I would like for him to just like go for it. And then he kind of like, you know, he'll body into the guy and take a foul, and we've got another free kick, which we didn't seem to be able to do anything with. But
yeah, he's not a very direct player. You know, he does like to dance around with the ball, and he'll invite that contact and then take it. And, you know, that's maybe, you know, a reason to put him in the middle of the field. You know, you put him in the middle of the field, he's going to be more direct by nature, just because he's in better spots, you know, in relation to the goal. And then if he does get hacked down, these fouls are, you know, in good spots, like decent free kick opportunities instead of, you know, over on the wing.
That's a good point. Let's move into the stuff we learned from these games. I feel like the midfield is a problem. We couldn't connect through the middle. A lot of decent players, but nobody stood out as the guy who can control the middle of the pitch. Probably the winner of this group for me, and it's a little bit faint praise, was Tavon Gray. I'll just mention the other midfielders. Will Riley, Peter Stroud, Gray, of course, Danny Robles, and Gianluca Busio. Am I missing anybody?
Saldana.
Oh, yes, Adam Saldana. So Gray was the one who kind of emerged for me as potentially useful going forward, because he's a workhorse who covers a lot of ground, and he grew on the ball in these three games. Thought he had his best game against Brazil. He was the kind of the bright spot, in my opinion. But he's not going to orchestrate possession, and nobody else sort of took on that role. Maybe you're right. Maybe Reyna could have been that guy if he had been consistently played at that sort of eight. But Saldana, Robles, and Busio each made a strong claim for, you know, least effective player on the whole roster. And they were the ones played in the more advanced midfield role.
Robles, who I was very high on after watching him in USL for Seattle 2, did not play well against Turkey and didn't see the field again. So that seems like problem number one. Who are going to play at central midfield? How are we going to play him there? I'm kind of at a loss.
Yeah, it's hard to say that you come out of the Nike friendlies feeling good about this midfield. And I think that the midfield issues are partially to blame on the coaching staff. I'll preface this by saying that Seguirus is a developmentally focused guy who hasn't historically shied away from playing players in difficult spots. But to take the Portugal game, for example, I don't understand the midfield lineup of Saldana, Gray, and Riley. Saldana was played as basically a number 10, and he looked thoroughly uncomfortable in the more advanced position that he was asked to play. Gray played a far more structured, like, ball at his feet role than he's used to playing, both for this team and for NYCFC. And Riley, who hasn't played above the U17 level anywhere and barely knows this group, was asked to do maybe the most important role of connecting the defense to the attack, which completely fell apart, you know, after like the 15th minute. There are three players that were never going to all adapt well to new roles, and, you know, understandably, each had issues.
I was initially more impressed with Riley than most people. I thought he was pretty comfortable on the ball and, you know, able to work his way out of some tough little situations and at least find somebody's feet. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't playing amazing passes through the lines or anything, but he was a decent, I thought he was a decent connector and maybe the best at that from what I saw, but he only played in the first game. So I wouldn't stake my life on that.
I did like Riley, you know, as a player that almost none of us had seen before. He's kind of coming out of nowhere, and I think that he had a pretty admirable performance in that game, you know, in a pretty tough role, what he was asked to do against, you know, a much higher level of competition than he's used to playing. And he's definitely a player I'd like to see again, especially if we could get, you know, you could put a player like Gray behind him and then put an actual, you know, attacking midfielder in front of him for him to connect to. Because the Saldana, especially in the first half, was dire in the Portugal game.
Yeah.
I don't think he added anything going forward.
This just occurs to me as we're talking, but Riley looked pretty good. Not great, but okay. Slightly better than okay. Against what was the toughest, clearly the toughest team in the tournament. You know, Portugal, yeah. Portugal rolled over Turkey and Brazil after drawing with us. So I don't know.
I think that he fits what this team wants to do better than, you know, I really like Gray and Stroud, but I think that Riley fits alongside one of them more than Stroud and Gray are playing well together. The danger of playing a 4-2-3-1 with two D mids who aren't comfortable stepping into the attack is that the attack and defense become disconnected. You have a block of six in defense and four attackers that need to check back to the ball, that need to check back to get on the ball. And it doesn't make for, you know, anything approaching a free-flowing attack. And I think that if you were to, you know, to take Stroud out of that and put Riley in, give Riley a couple more games in the system, then we would have seen some better soccer than we saw over the last couple of days.
Who are the absences that you are? I mean, we talked about them a little bit, but do you think Josh Atencio could help solve these problems, or Gilbert Fuentes maybe as the 10, or even as the one of the sixes?
Yeah, if we are going to play with two sixes, I don't think it makes any sense for it to be Gray and Stroud unless we're up against a team that's clearly better on the ball than we are, and I'm not sure that team exists at this point, you know, in a U17 cycle. There's no team in the world that's passing around people, you know, like you see at the senior team level. It just doesn't happen. We played against Portugal and Brazil in this, you know, tournament. Neither of those teams really passed around us.
I mean, Brazil kind of passed around us.
Okay. Maybe Brazil kind of did, but, it, you know, that maybe has something to do with the lack of a midfield we kind of had. by playing Stroud and Gray together. Like I definitely would have liked to see Fuentes in here. I think of him as more of an eight. You know, Joey thinks he's so good on the ball that he makes sense on the wing. Like I just, you don't get that level of quality on the ball from Gray and Stroud, who played the majority of the minutes in midfield.
Yeah. The arrangement that comes to mind for me is trying Atencio next to Gray and then maybe Fuentes ahead of them and seeing how that goes. Maybe the concern from Seciris is we'd just be a little bit soft defensively because Atencio is not like a big bruiser. I mean, he's a big kid, but he's not a bruiser in the tackle, and he's not he doesn't cover a ton of ground.
Yeah, and it's a valid concern, but maybe I've just formulated an opinion on this group a little too early. But in my opinion, the goal of the game plan, especially when Bello's with the team, but even without him, should be to get the fullbacks involved in the attack. I like some of the midfielders in this age group, but there isn't much of a doubt in my mind that our most dangerous two-way players this cycle play fullback.
Yeah,
the easiest way to get the fullbacks up the field is to play a central midfield that's dangerous enough to pull numbers from the flanks. And our midfield wasn't remotely dangerous by themselves in this tournament. There was barely any vertical ball movement within the midfield, let alone creativity.
Right. Like, okay.
You could argue every single central midfielder the U.S. played in this tournament, save Busio, projects as a six.
And Busio is a whole nother discussion. I mean, he's a hard case to figure out because he was really bad in this game against Brazil. I mean, like couldn't take a clean touch levels of bad. And, you know, this is a guy who has been entrusted with regular minutes in Major League Soccer by one of the best teams, and a coach who clearly isn't handing out charity minutes, Peter Vermes, and yet he comes into this camp and didn't look good.
Yeah, I'm willing to give Busio a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. You know, he hasn't played in a little while now.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, a good amount of travel, you know, for this tournament and with Kansas City. So maybe he was just a little rusty. I've seen enough of him in MLS that I'm excited about him, and I'm not necessarily going to let him laying an egg against Brazil, you know, sully my view of him. I think he's a part of this team going forward.
And he did score a pretty nice goal, so let's not forget that. I'm reminding myself not to forget that. I'd like to see Fuentes and Atencio.
Yeah.
I know other people I've talked to, they like the way Stroud kind of competes and fights, and they think that's an important quality that is needed in there. I don't discount that, but I just wasn't super impressed with him either. Why don't we move on to your first point?
Yeah, I thought that the defense was solid, but that it came at the expense of the attack. And, like I said earlier, Portugal discovered early in the first game that they could expose our center backs with diagonal runs through the middle, especially after rather easily pulling Kobe Hernandez out of position. Hernandez was attacking the ball like a fullback, you know, because he is a fullback. I'm not going to really say that he should blame him much for that, especially since he got much better as the tournament went on. But after the opening 15 minutes of that Portugal game, it became kind of clear that Hernandez and Alejandro needed help. And I think after that point, the back six played a little more compact than we may have envisioned going in.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of played, you know, in a block of six at the back, with two central defensive midfielders for the rest of the tournament. And it worked. We only allowed, you know, two goals in three games against some pretty good competition, but it also limited the effect, you know, a player like Scally could have on the game. And I don't think that's what we want, given two of our three best players on the ball in this cycle are fullbacks.
The plan needs to be capital T, capital P. The plan needs to be to, like, get Bello and Scally into the attack.
Yeah, I mean, that problem is mostly on the center backs, right? Like, if the center backs can't hold their own, then, I mean, you know, center back is a problem this cycle. We've known that, but no, I guess I'm a little disappointed by how much cover we needed at the back.
Yeah. Well, it was Alejandre and Hernandez in the first game. Like you mentioned, Hernandez did get better in the Turkey game, and I thought he had a very good game against Turkey and a pretty good game against Brazil. Do you think Alejandre was so bad in that game that he, you know, didn't get to play again until the last 10 minutes of the Brazil game at central defensive midfield?
Yeah. He didn't do anything particularly memorable. Like, from what I could remember, he just was, you know, there was a gaping hole in the middle of the defense early on in that game. And I think that Alejandro doesn't necessarily do anything as good as Hernandez or Judge does. I mean, I guess his decision making might be a little better than Judge's is, but I think after this group of games, you know, him not having a standout game in any way in the first game, and then basically, you know, getting benched for the tournament, I think it's fair to say his roster spot might be under question for the next set of games.
Yeah. But then his replacement, Judge, was, I don't know, am I being harsh that he was really bad? I mean, I feel like he could have gifted the opponents five goals by himself over two games.
Yeah, I think that is a little harsh. I think that Judge is still a player that I'm excited to see how he develops. But he's kind of a little reminiscent of like Omar Gonzalez to me, in that he looks a good defender 90% of the time and just has these critical lapses in judgment. He had a great tackle in the midfield to win the ball that ended in the Busio goal in the Brazil game.
Yep.
He committed the foul from which Brazil scored their goal.
Yeah, a questionable foul call, to be fair to him.
Sure. He made the goal line clearance to keep the clean sheet against Turkey, but as we talked about before, he was the reason why he needed to make that goal line clearance.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's one of the players in this group I've seen the most of, and I still don't know if I rate him or not. He's an interesting player.
Hmm.
Definitely not as secure as you'd like a center back to be, but I think that he could have a future at the position.
Okay. Here's my second thought. Adding George Bello will help a lot. Ding, 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 yeah. Ding, ding.
Right.
I could see, like we were just sort of discussing, you can see this team having a very distinctive plan of attacking up the flanks with Bello and Scally, almost having them provide the width and having your wingers even tuck in a little bit on occasion. That's oftentimes the way that U-20s looked in the CONCACAF championship, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree.
With Goslin and Dest towards the end of the, not Goslin, Gloucester and Dest towards the end of the tournament. So that could be, that's something that could really work. And it would also play to the strengths of Busio and Reyna if they're in fact going to be wingers, because they're not like really feet on the chalk kind of guys necessarily. And then another way it works is if you have Tavon Gray, or maybe even you have that 2-6 kind of setup, like Tavon Gray and Peter Stroud, it makes a little more sense, because they're going to be, I mean, Gray will be able to cover a lot of ground and, you know, cover for those guys when they're bombing forward. I could see that making sense. I guess that's my point.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Bello is, you know, one of the two best players. I don't know, maybe if you rate Loss very highly, then one of the three best players. But I think he's one of the two best players in this group. And, you know, I said that, you know, fullback is a low impact position, but if you look at the way that this team plays, and or at least this team wants to play, he's one of the most critical pieces to accomplishing that, especially with there not being, you know, a player at left wing who can necessarily get it done by himself if Reyna's not playing there.
Right. Yeah, did you think Did you think any of the wingers, any of the true wingers you saw was move the needle? I'm thinking of Yao and Dunbar, really.
One of my thoughts coming out of this, out of the friendlies, was that Yao might not be a good enough goal-scoring threat to start on the wing. Credit him for the goal that he had. It was all him. And you know, that type of work rate up front is something that
is valuable, Yeah,
it's valuable. You really can't discount, especially if there's a player like Bello behind him who can, you know, kind of take a little bit of the offensive pressure off of him. But Yao, I thought, never really looked as great with the ball at his feet in the tournament.
Or in combination with other players, which maybe is harsh because there just didn't seem to be like any combining going on around the field by anybody.
Yeah.
That's an overstatement, but you get my point. Like, right. not much.
You know, I like Yao, and I think that he's earned his place in this team. But if our forward line has Yao starting on the left wing, it doesn't exactly instill a ton of confidence in you that we're going to put up four on an imposing team. If they could shut Gio Reyna down, then where do the goals come from? Andre Costa, you know, got some game time, and it's hard to form an opinion on him, I think, based on how he played. He didn't really look prepared for what I'll call messy soccer. Like, he was looking for, you know, triangles that didn't necessarily exist.
Yeah.
Whatnot. But, and he's a player I'd like to see centrally. He's played some there for his club team, his current club team, Rayo Vallecano and Real Madrid. But, yeah, he I didn't think he looked good, particularly good. I'm kind of blanking on who else got minutes on the wing.
Well, Cameron Dunbar did, and I thought he had some somewhat bright moments. He didn't get a lot of minutes. I guess the thing I would say with him is he's probably in a good spot to develop attacking sophistication since he's at the LA Galaxy Academy, and our two most sophisticated attackers in the U20 roster in the last tournament were Ulianes and Alex Mendez. By sophisticated, I mean like just able to combine and aware passes and how to move and so forth.
Yeah, I'd agree. He's a player I wasn't very familiar with going in, and I think he showed me enough that I'd like to see him again in these teams. One more thing on the Bello situation is that I think that a lot of people that I've seen, you know, in the U.S. soccer sphere have kind of said that Adam Armour, who did play on that left wing spot, that in that left fullback spot that Bello would play in, had a very bad tournament. And I don't think Armour had as bad a tournament as a lot of people think. But, you know, there's no question that Bello would be a market improvement at the left back spot.
I mean, we're going to disagree a little bit there because I thought – I mean, Armour could have gotten sent off in the first half hour of the Portugal game. I mean, there was one tackle where he didn't even get called for a foul, and it was like a scissor. Yeah. He scissored the guy. And then, I don't know, I guess I'm just a little more – I've been used to watching the U20s. I've got Bello on the mind, and I'm watching Armour come down that flank. And, you know, he just didn't really generate anything with the ball at his feet. So – If what you're saying is he's a serviceable left back, I can agree with that.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. Do you think that we can rely on Bello to future for this team for the rest of the cycle, given his club status?
I think Atlanta will release him for at least for the U17 World Cup. You don't think so? I guess playoffs will be coming at that point
for Atlanta? Yeah, I don't have a great... a great calendar in my head of when the U17 tournaments.
The CONCACAF one hasn't even been announced yet.
Has it, right? Which is crazy, right? Is it not? That it hasn't even been announced?
Seems crazy to me, but what do I know?
Right. It's CONCACAF. You know, it's kind of that yin and yang of if he doesn't get called in, then I guess that's a good thing. You know, for the pool as a whole, if Bello is not getting called into U17 games because he's that important to the Atlantis side, but man, would it be, is that a blow to the U17s if they miss out on Melo?
Yeah, it's, and I looked it up, and it's the World Cup next year is from October 5 to October 27. So that's really crunch time in the MLS regular season. It'll be, I think, disappointing if Bello isn't playing something of a significant role for Atlanta by then. So maybe we can't count on him for this team. It's Adam Armour's job to lose.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm okay with that. Hearing that sentence out loud is maybe, you know, a little bit too much.
Well,
there are other fullbacks, you know, that we could potentially look at for that spot as well. So we should maybe not make it sound like Armour's our only option if Bello can't make it.
Yeah. Well, there's always the possibility that a center back would emerge and Kobe Hernandez can move to the fullback position, which is his natural position. He would be more than adequate there, I think. And I mean, more than adequate, he'd be good as a left back.
Yeah, but is he not like CB1 for you right now?
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah, he's CB1 for me, and I don't even know who CB2 would be. So yeah, lots to figure out on the defense there. Let's move on to the next point. What's your next one? Make it positive.
I think that Loss and Odunze were what we thought they would be. Loss was commanding in his box, made a couple of good saves, had pretty solid distribution. He came up with a couple of big saves and only had one moment, I think, in the Brazil goal that I think that where he may have been able to do better. Like you said before, you and we are both not goalkeeping experts, but I do think it's fair to ask questions of his footwork and if he screened himself with his own wall
mm-hmm.
on that goal, because watching it back a couple of times, I don't think that he ever really got a good look at that ball until it was, it was past the wall. It still would have been a great save, but I think that he showed why he's the one this cycle, even if he didn't have to stand on his head like he did at the Nike friendlies last year.
Yeah, he comes out of his box on through balls like a bat out of hell, and just like he just claims that ball. There is no doubt about it. It's really nice to see.
The Turkey game was your first time seeing Odunze, right?
I think so. I'm not sure. Probably. The only thing I noticed is he's, anything in the air is just like so easy for him to claim. So don't try to cross the ball into the box with him. I mean, he did get caught in no man's land on that chance we discussed earlier where Hernandez did so well and Judge cleared it off the line.
Has always kind of been the issue with Odunze. For every great save he makes, he like inexplicably charges out of his box at somebody and gets caught off the line. It's just strange.
Yeah, I can't. I'd have to watch that back to figure out what he was thinking there. But he got he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And luckily it didn't result in a goal. I think everybody who's watched these games is excited about Loss. He's really good. And Odunze is a plenty exciting number two,
Yeah, totally. What you want in a number two, right? A player that, perhaps if everything goes right, could be better than the number one, even if he's not ready for it right now. You don't need your second goalkeeper to be, the steadiest of goalkeepers at this point as a U17 player.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Gio Reyna? Let's get into that. That's going to be the headline of this squad for most people.
Right. I think that he was clearly the best player on the field for the U.S. And, I didn't see many of the games that the U.S. didn't play, but I think that it would be hard to not say that he was one of the most talented players in the whole tournament. The question for Reyna still is, I'm not, I don't know where he plays exactly. He was great on the wings for us, and you know he's able to glide past players, and even if he may not be athletic enough, you know, from a pure speed perspective to be a winger long term, I think that he's plenty athletic enough to do it at this level. It's just that I think I'd like to see him move into a position, you know, get familiarity with a position that he can play long term sometime soon, instead of just, you know, throwing him out here on the wings.
Yeah, I didn't come away at all concerned about his athleticism.
Right.
Like maybe he's not going to win a 100-yard dash with most fullbacks, but he has the technique and the quickness to get past him and get a cross off. Yeah,
he's the best winger in this pool, and he would have been one of the best wingers in the two previous pools. It's just, you know, maybe I'm projecting a little too far forward, but you know, I don't, if he's going to be the level of player that I think that he can be, I just don't see that, you know, coming from him on the wing. I think that he could be a very, very good pro player on the wing, but his ceiling in the center of the park is just a lot higher, whether it be, you know, like as a second striker or a 10 or maybe even an 8.
Yeah. I guess I just don't know what I think about that yet. Had he been supported by a midfield that could connect and get the ball to him, like let's say Alex Mendez was playing as the 10 for this team, it would have been a different tournament for Gio Reyna. He would have gotten the ball in much more dangerous spots, and as it was, he ended up starting on the wing, and then you know he kind of just went all over the field and sort of sought out the ball. I'm not sure how I felt about that. I guess I do know how I felt about it. I was a little uneasy with it because it sort of, you know, he would get into other people's space and there just wasn't a lot of cohesion there. And I'm going to pick on him. I mean, I agree. He's the best. He's clearly the most exciting player on the roster. He's got this ability to glide by people and use his body to shield the ball, and you know he won fouls, and he could dribble out of tight space. I mean, a lot of stuff that you just can't teach, right? He's got it. But I'm going to pick on him a little bit, and it's sort of a comment about the whole group that there just wasn't any off-ball movement. Players running off a teammate who was receiving the ball, and cohesion or unselfishness and teamwork, to use a very simple word, going on in the attack. And I think he was a big part of that, because he would just get the ball, put his head down and dribble, and then kind of look for a pass, you know? And it's my same criticism I have of Pulisic. I mean, they're very, very reminiscent of each other, don't you think, Reyna and Pulisic?
Yeah, they are, you know, in some very good ways and in some less good ways. I'd agree that I was a little disappointed with Reyna's off the ball movement, but you know, especially with, you know, a player like Scally on the overlap with him, a player that he's, you know, fairly used to playing with. And they did overlap a couple of times and connect with the ball, but it wasn't what you'd like to see. And Reyna did do a lot of, you know, standing around or, you know, just kind of walking towards the ball, hoping that, you know, somebody finds his feet. Like we started the show with it, that could be a lack. These players haven't played with each other to the extent that previous U17 cycles have.
Well, it's either that or it's a fundamental flaw in the American soccer development ecosystem.
Yeah. I think we both have an opinion on that is pretty easy for listeners to assume.
I'm not sure what it is. What is the opinion?
Yeah, it is it's a fundamentally like American thing. I don't know that I've ever seen another I'll say good, you know, soccer nation have the amount of, you know, stand aroundism as American players do sometimes on the field.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's, you know, it becomes an individual sport at times for some players. Like, when I get the ball, I'm going to do this, you know?
Yep, and then I'm going to try to hit, like, a golazo or a home run pass with my final touch. And we saw that it doesn't have to be that way. Like, the perfect example was Alex Mendez to Pomacall at the top of the box. Simple little 1-2. Pomacall flicks Mendez in behind, and he tucks it through the goalkeeper's legs. It was, like, the most beautiful goal in American soccer since
when was Pulisic's last good goal for the national team?
Yeah, I mean, there were some nice ones in that Panama win before we crashed at Trinidad and Tobago. Some nice goals in that game. But, you know, it's hard to see a player like Gio Reyna, as talented as he is, making the decision to just the simple little pass to the guy who's 3 yards away and then the run right off it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't see much of that from Busio either. I'll grant you, Busio, we'll give Busio a pass. It was a weird appearance for him.
And Busio has showed the ability to combine in MLS. So.
Has he?
Yeah, I think that he's, you know, that assist that he had against Houston was a give and go.
That's true.
He received the ball and then had that really nice ball through the lines to put whoever that player was in behind for Kansas City.
I think it was Rubio, yeah.
And I think that he's done that, you know, less attacking situations, just to circle the ball around for Kansas City, but definitely didn't show it against Brazil.
Right. Well, Reyna, back to Reyna, I think the raw ability there is unmistakable, and you got to imagine he's kind of outgrown the development academy. Definitely the development academy. I think he just feels, it looks like he's just not being, hasn't been challenged to be sort of a part of a cohesive team. That's just me, you know, wildly speculating, but I guess what I'm saying by all this is, like, go to Dortmund and maybe they'll help him figure that out.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting to see what happens with Reyna now that you know, this tournament's over. Basically, he should be heading to Dortmund fairly soon. He's 16, right? He can go. It's just waiting.
Yeah, because he has a passport, a European passport. All right.
Definitely be exciting to see how he progresses.
The one other player I wanted to mention was Ricardo Pepi, who we talked about a little bit earlier. He came on as the 9 against Turkey. He scored the goal, which we already discussed. I thought he showed himself to be the best 9 of any of the recent call-ups. Now, there may be another U17 9 out there somewhere that hasn't been discovered yet. It's very possible. But for right now, I'm saying Pepe's the best 9 in the age group. And I really liked what I saw from him against Turkey. He didn't play as well in his cameo against Portugal, and he didn't play as well against Brazil. But he still did a lot of good things against Brazil. He's a hard worker. He's big. He's physical. He's got that ability in tight space to take a couple little touches and find somebody's feet. Not every time, but he can do it. And kind of reminds me of Diego Lopez, just slightly more comfortable navigating tight space with the ball at his feet.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know what.
He's surprisingly good with the ball at his feet for his size. He was a midfielder and, you know, was forced into playing as more of a striker when he had a growth spurt. So I think that you could see that in his game. Like you said, he seems very comfortable in tight spaces. I think that he's a really good piece for this team. I'm maybe not ready to anoint him the number 9 for the cycle yet, for the rest of the cycle yet. But I think that he's definitely a good piece, and even if I don't know if he's going to create his own chances.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part of it that we didn't really get to see was him actually scoring goals, except for that one. And he did have some chances in front of goal that went begging. So hardly an open and shut case. Just in terms of what was asked of the nine in these games, which was a lot of hard work and holding the ball up and, you know, hoping against hope that he could find somebody's feet, he was just way more suited for that than Ocampo Chavez was.
Yeah, 100%. I think that if you look at even within the Dallas youth setup, Ricardo Pepi plays for the U17s, and there's an O3, a player that's younger than him, that is eligible for this age group in Dante Sealy, who plays for the U19s. And, you know, Pepi has an outrageous goal scoring record in the DA, but so does Sealy. He has, I think, 10 goals and 8 starts or something like that, and is playing up an age group. So, you know, initially it's like, why should Pepi, who is older and playing for the U, still playing with the U17s, why does he deserve a call up over Dante Sealy, who plays, you know, at the very least a similar position, even if he plays it a little differently? And I think that the reasoning is exactly what you just mentioned, that he's just a better fit for what the striker needed to be in these Nike friendlies.
Yeah. I mean, Sealy's a little bit more of a winger, right?
He plays on the right wing. I think that he played, I haven't seen any of the games yet, but from what I've heard, he's played up more up top in the winter showcase. He had 4 goals in those 3 games. So if he didn't play as a lone striker, I think that he played more as a wide forward, but he can play as a striker. He has done that before.
Okay.
I think that's where he projects. Like, I think that he is a striker.
Huh. Okay. I didn't realize that. All right. No anointment coming from Hartman on Pepi. I can understand that. I was just looking for somebody who could come back to the ball, hold it up, find somebody's feet. That's what I'm always on the lookout for. And he combined with Reyna a couple times in a nice way.
I really like Pepi. I'm excited to see him to be a piece of this team going forward.
One thing we should address is Alfonso Ocampo Chavez. You know, he didn't look particularly good in that first game. Is there a role for him that's different than that sort of hardworking nine that Pepi was better at?
Yeah, the only place that I've ever seen Ocampo Chavez play other than up top has been on the right wing. And I think that he is quite a good right winger. I think that I would have liked to have seen him opposite Reyna, with maybe Pepi up top in this tournament. But I don't know if he's good enough there that, you know, you can put him into the lineup and be happy with it. I think that Ocampo Chavez has some flaws as a player that he needs to kind of work through in terms of
stand-aroundism.
Right. Stand-aroundism, how good he is on the ball when he gets it, like on a per 90 basis, because you can make some pretty good good touch compilations of Ocampo Chavez, but when you watch him play a full 90 minutes, it's like, you know, a lot of waste. And then the good thing happens in tournaments like this, when you're coming up against the level of competition that we played, I could see why he wasn't played in that position. And, it, you know, it's a very similar thing for his Seattle teammate, Ray Serrano.
Yeah. All right.
So a player I rate, I think that he'll progress and has a future in Seattle, but maybe just wasn't the fit, you know, for this team.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, maybe he's, I was discussing this with Adam Whitaker Snavely on Twitter, and, you know, he suggested he could be like a second striker in some formations. That does kind of seem to fit AOC's profile a little bit more, but I don't think it's going to happen with the US U17s. I don't think they're going to all of a sudden start playing a 3-5-2 or a, you know, 4-4-2 or something.
I'd agree with him that Ocampo Chavez, like, you look at his skill set, and I think it could fit pretty well into a second striker skill set, but it's just a hard formation to fit this U17 team into.
Okay, last point over to you.
My last point is that I think that that some of the players that weren't in this camp, in particular the O3s, have a pretty good chance to break into this team. There are a number of players like Sealy that I just mentioned. An O2 in Atencio, O2s in Atencio and Fuentes, as you mentioned earlier, and then some players like Walls at center back and Moses Nyman in central midfield, who I think if you look at where the holes are in this roster in terms of where the obvious places that we could use improvement are, those are some players that can fit pretty nicely into those spots if they could keep progressing. And I'd be shocked if one of Walls, Sealy, Atencio Fuentes, Nyman, or a player like Seguir Arce, who's a Mexican-American, who's a Mexican-American striker who's currently playing down in Mexico, I'd be shocked if one of them doesn't break into this team before the CONCACAF qualifying starts.
Yeah, I'd like to see more of all those players. Nyman has been injured a lot, and I think he's still sort of getting back to fitness. But
yeah, he actually played for DC in the Winter Showcase while these Nike friendlies were going on. I saw the game that they played. I forget who they played against. DC played against a fairly good team. It might have been Dallas, but they got killed. He didn't look particularly good in the game, but I still like him going forward.
Yeah. I actually think I saw him on the telecast of the Brazil game on the sidelines watching. So I'm pretty sure. I'm 90% sure it was him. I'll get a GIF and put it out for confirmation. So yeah, those are all exciting names. There's going to be a camp in January. Tab Ramos told me that last week, where there's going to be this U17s, the U20s, and one other age group. It won't be a full-on Tab Ramos mega camp, but it'll be a sort of a slightly lesser version of that. I think our work here is done.
Alrighty.
Anything else?
Nope. Nothing else to add. I think we just about did it.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on again, Adam.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you.